Those tears, what are they?
Jason asked, awed.
Whatever I choose them to be.
I don't understand.
If you still had the Force, it would be obvious.
Females of my species have very sophisticated lacrimal glands. Even the Force blind could alter their tears to produce a wide range of pheromonal signals and chemical intoxicants for use on our males. Using the Force, my control is very precise. I can match the molecular structure of my tears to my desire. Whether that desire be a systemic cure for Coombe spore infection, or merely a potent topical antibiotic with instant steroidal properties.
Wow,
Jason breathed, his heart stung with sudden hope.
I mean, wow.
Vergere, do you think, would you, could I? She gazed at him steadily.
Ask.
There are so many, he began. There's a slave, a Bothan, Trask. He shattered his ankle. Pelon Minor, he's human. He was the first one to find out that the amphistaph polyps in that grove over there are mature enough to attack.
Peritonitis. He's dying.
Nothing you have said is a question or a request.
Vergere blinked once, slowly, then again.
Ask.
Your tears, Vergere. You could save so many lives.
Yes, I could.
Please, Vergere. Will you?
No.
Please.
No, Jason Solo. I will not.
Why should I?
They are slaves.
They're people.
Tell me this, Jason Solo.
What distinguishes a flower from a weed?
Vergere.
This is not a riddle.
What distinguishes a flower from a weed is only and exactly this. The choice of the gardener.
I'm not a gardener, Jason said, biting down on his temper. And these are not weeds.
She shrugged.
Again, our difficulties may be linguistic. To me, a gardener is one who chooses what to cultivate and what to uproot. Who decides which lives must end so that the lives he cherishes may flourish.
You're the gardener, he muttered sullenly, staring at his hands. I'm just one of the weeds.
How is it, she asked slowly, that you have come to be the medical droid for your slave gang?
There's no one else who can do it.
The Duryam approves?
Let's say it took some convincing.
And how did you manage to convince it?
Jason stared through her, remembering his savage private struggle against the slave seed and the Duryam that controlled it, day after day of bitter agony. The Duryam was an intelligent creature. It had not taken long to discover that Jason could not be moved by pain. The turning point had come when the Duryam realized that it had been pouring so much energy and attention into its struggle with Jason that it was neglecting its other slaves. Its domain in the nursery was falling to ruin, becoming a wasteland among the lush domains of its sibling rivals, and it soon began to discover that Jason could be useful, even unbroken. Jason had taken every respite from the pain to minister to his fellow slaves. The Duryam had eventually seemed to understand that healthy slaves can work harder, and soon its domain began to improve again. But he said nothing of this. He owed Vergere no answers.
I told you before, he muttered solidly. You can kill me, but you can't make me obey.
And that, Jason Solo, is why you are a flower among the weeds.
You're Sith, aren't you?
She went still.
Am I?
I know a little about the dark side, Vergere. All this garbage about flowers and weeds, I know what you're really talking about. You're talking about believing you're above people.
Her first motion, a faint curve at the corners of her lips.
Sith, Jedi, are these the only choices? Dark or light, good or evil? Is there no more to the Force than this?
Jason got up. I don't have time for this. They'll turn on the sun in a few minutes. He started walking toward the resting slaves. Vergier spoke to his departing back. If the Force is life, how can there be life without the Force?
What?
Jason stopped. He looked over his shoulder.
What?
You are born to be a gardener, she said. Remember this. It is not only your right to choose flowers over weeds. It is your responsibility. Which are flowers? Which are weeds? The choice is yours.
With a lightning crackle and a wavefront blast of thunder, the nursery's sun kindled overhead. Jason flinched, shading his eyes against the sudden flare. And by the time he could see again, Vergère was far away, hopping from hummock to hummock across the Von Dune crab bog. He stared after her.
If the Force is life, how can there be life without the Force?
The question haunted him. Vergère could have been talking about his life. How could he live without the Force? The answer was, of course, that he couldn't. He didn't. The Force was there. He just couldn't feel it. Anakin used to say that the Force was a tool, like a hammer. If the Force's a hammer, Jason decided, then he was a carpenter with his arms cut off. He couldn't even see the hammer anymore. He couldn't remember what it looked like.
If I came of a species that had never had arms, I wouldn't recognize a hammer. And I'd have no use for it, even if I somehow guessed what it was. A hammer would have nothing to do with me at all. Like the Force has nothing to do with the Yuuzhan Vong.
That was half an answer, but the other half kept wriggling, chewing at the inside of his skull. Because the Force was not just a tool. There was a mystery here, one that nagged at him. Fortunately, he had plenty of time to think about it. As the days blended one into the next, the Duryam seemed to gain an understanding of what Jason did. Through the slave seed, the Duryam had sent occasional small, almost affectionate twinges, more like a pinch from a playmate than the crack of a slave master's whip. And Jason discovered that if he followed where these twinges directed him, he might find, say, a type of moss with immunostimulant properties, or a secretion of the Von Dune crabs that acted as a natural antiseptic. Almost as though the Duryam were trying to help. If the Force is life, how can there be life without the Force? The realization did not come as a blinding revelation, but rather as a slow dawning of awareness, an incremental gathering of comprehension. So that on a steel-colored noon, when he looked down from a hillock onto the Duryam Hive Island, he knew and understood and was neither surprised nor astonished at his new knowledge and understanding. This was what he knew and understood. The answer for the Yuuzhan Vong was the same as the answer for himself. There is no life without the Force. The human eye does not register electromagnetic energy outside the tiny band of frequencies called visible light. But even though you can't see them, those frequencies exist. The Yuuzhan Vong and their creations must participate in a part of the Force that is beyond the range of Jedi senses. That's all. Jason had always had a particular gift for making friends with alien species. He used to call it empathy. But it had always been more than shared emotion. It had been an improvised language that operated through a part of the Force that other Jedi didn't seem able to sense. Standing on the hillock, under the blue-white fusion ball noon, Jason began a cycle of breath that would ease his mind into Jedi focus. He reached down inside himself, feeling for the presence of the slave seed that was the Duryam's link to him. And his link to the Duryam. He felt it, where it coiled along his nerves, an alien animal sharing his body. Hey there, little guy, he said inside himself.
Let's be friends.
The view spider stood on a spray of 9 slim-jointed legs that arched high from its central hub before curving down to support its weight on grip-clawed feet. Below its central hub hung a transparent sack large enough to hold a Wookiee, filled to bulging with optical jelly. The central hub also held the view spider's brain, which integrated telepathic signals channeled from a variety of the slave seeds that drove the creatures in the nursery. It integrated these signals into a holographic image created within the jelly medium by the intersection of phased electromagnetic pulses from a cluster of glands where the jelly sac attached to the brain hub. Noma Noor studied this image with a certain satisfaction, as did Vergere, who crouched on the chamber floor beyond the view spider. The subject in question was Jason Solo.
"So,"
Noma Noor said,
"you say the second step is complete. The Duryam has successfully seduced him?"
"Or he, the Duryam. It is the same. To create the empathic bond, as he has done, requires each of them to downplay their differences and focus on all they have in common. Yes, the second step is complete."
"So..."
Noma Noor leaned back and folded his long, bony fingers across his chest.
"Jason Solo has, for the moment, an alarming degree of freedom."
"Freedom is always alarming," Vergere agreed.
Noma Noor waved this aside.
"Giving him room to act is one thing. Giving him that room in this ship is another."
"You believe he could threaten the ship? How?"
"I do not know. But I have not survived this much of the war by underestimating Jedi, particularly the Solo family. I am concerned. Even the slightest threat to this ship is far too great a risk."
He had no need to elaborate. Vergere knew already that the genetic material that had gone into the creation of the seed ship was irreplaceable. Gene samples preserved through the incalculable millennia of the Yuuzhan Vong's intergalactic voyage aboard the worldships. Samples preserved from a homeworld so long vanished in the dust of history that not even its name survived.
"Ease your mind, Noma Noor. Has not each step gone perfectly so far?"
He scowled.
"I distrust such easy victories. Leave me. Maintain your vigilance. In fact, intensify it. These last few days before seedfall will be especially dangerous. Take no chances."
"As you say, Executor."
Vergere favored him with a millimetrically correct bow, then opened the chamber's hatch sphincter and climbed out. And Noma Noor, in his cautious, methodical way, took his own advice. As soon as Vergere left, Noma Noor sent a message by Villip to the commander of a special detachment of warriors. This detachment had been brought aboard and specially trained for just such a moment as this. He issued a short string of orders. Before the end of the day, warriors in Ooglith maskers would begin to infiltrate the other slave gangs in the nursery. They would stay well away from Jason Solo, conceal their presence, and wait. When the Deveronian died, Jason thought, "Okay, maybe I was wrong." He knelt on the Hive Lake's verge. A mob of injured, wounded, and sick slaves surged and shouted around him, hands and tentacles and talons reaching for him, tugging at his robe skin. His robe skin had soaked up a lot of blood before Jason had managed to tourniquet the stump of the Deveronian's arm. The Deveronian's silver-based blood was black as tarnish and smelled of burned sulfur. From his link with the Duryam through the slave seed in his chest, Jason could faintly perceive his robe skin's primitive delight at the blood's unusual flavor. As weeks passed, Jason and the Duryam had learned to communicate more precisely through the medium of the slave seed. He could now exchange information with the Duryam in the form of emotions and images. By using these in combination, they had developed a wide-ranging mutual vocabulary, but their connection had gone beyond this. At first, his own Duryam had tried to stop Jason from treating slaves who belonged to its sibling rivals. For nearly a day, Jason and the Duryam had gone back to their war of unendurable pain against unbreakable will. Through it all, Jason had kept hearing Vergere's voice echo inside his head. "Which are flowers? Which are weeds? The choice is yours." He had chosen. No agony at any Duryam's command could unmake his choice. There are no weeds here. Every slave was a flower. Every life was precious. He would spend the last erg of his strength to save every one of them. He had built an aid station near the bank of the lake that surrounded the Duryam Hive Island. His own Duryam had cooperated to the point of giving Jason the occasional help of a few members of his slave gang to gather medicinal mosses and herbs, supplies of clip beetles, and young robeskins that could be used for bandages. The Deveronian had been one of these temporary assistants. Jason had sent him upland for a bundle of grain-bearing grasses that grew on a nearby hillock. When ground fine, these grains made an excellent coagulant and were mildly antibiotic. Before he could return, the crowd of wounded had grown to a mob. The Deveronian had tried to skirt the mob by slipping around the Hive Pond shore, since the ring of Yuuzhan'vong warriors around it prevented the mob from extending in that direction. It was this that had killed him. He'd heard the harsh bark of a warrior's order at the edge of the pond, and he'd looked up in time to see a flicker of amphistaff blade conjure a jet of shimmering black blood. He had pushed and shoved and fought his way through the mob to find the Deveronian lying on his back in a scatter of the grasses he had carried, one hand clutching at the stump of his other arm. Jason had had time to gaze into the Deveronian's vivid red eyes, to read there a puzzled sadness at the useless, empty, arbitrary death that now swallowed him. That's when Jason thought, okay, maybe I was wrong. There were weeds here, after all. He lifted his head and met the eyes of a weed. The warrior who had killed the Deveronian returned his gaze impassively, black-smeared amphistaff at the ready. Expressionlessly, Jason rose and turned his back on the warrior and moved away into the mob. He'd decided who the weeds were. "You want gardening? Just wait. I'll show you gardening. Just you wait." A battered, barren world circled a blue-white spark of fusion fire. This world had seen the rise and fall of nation after nation, from simple provincial states to planetary confederations, to interstellar empires and galactic republics. It had been the scene of a million battles, from simple surface skirmishes to the destruction of whole civilizations. It had been ravaged by war and reconstruction until its original environment survived only beneath sterile polar ice caps. It was the most artificial world of a galactic culture devoted to artifice. The whole planet had become a machine. This was about to change. Its new masters began by stealing its moons. Stripped from orbit by Dovin basal gravity drives, the three smaller moons were steered well away, while the largest was pulverized by tidal stress created by pulses from other Yamask-linked Dovin basals. A refined application of similar techniques organized the resultant mass of dust and gravel and lumps of hardening magma into a thick-spreading ring disk of rubble that rotated around the planet at an angle 17 degrees from the ecliptic. This, while dramatic in itself, was only a prologue. Dovin basals had been grown on the planet's surface. The effect of gravity can be profitably described topographically as an altered curvature of space-time. The Dovin basals on the planet's surface altered the curve of local space-time in such a way that the direction of the planet's orbit became, roughly speaking, uphill. The planet slowed. Slowing, it fell inward toward its sun. It got warmer. Once the planet had spiraled into its revised orbit, the Dovin basals quieted, and space returned to its customary topography. The three remaining moons were moved back into new, more complex orbits, whose tidal effects would eventually braid the striated disk of rubble that ringed the planet into a permanent sky bridge of rainbow lace. By the time the seed ship fell back into normal space and moved toward an orbital intercept, the planet duplicated in its gross elements of orbital length, rotation, moons, and rings, the eon-lost homeworld of the Yuuzhan Vong. It remained only to remake the surface and bring life to the shattered remnants of what once had been a single planet-wide city, so that the planet could grow into the name it would bear. Yuuzhan Tar, the Creche of God. Coruscant was ready for seedfall. In the nursery, it was the Tezopil Yunchilat, the day of comprehending the will of the gods. In these last few hours before seedfall, teams of shapers fanned out through the Duryam's domains, measuring, calculating, indexing, and evaluating. Each shaper team walked in company with a squad of towering, lanky warriors, heavily armored, weapons at the ready, glittering eyes scanning ceaselessly, moving with the ponderously sinister threat of reeks in mating season. Four squads guarded the Shri Yam Tees. A small, specialized subspecies of Yamaxk, this speeder-sized creature existed only to emit a powerful interference signal in the telepathic band used by Yamasks and Duryams alike. The squads had carried the barrel-bodied Shri Yam Tees into the nursery in a huge basin filled with nutrient fluid. This was the first act of the Tezopil Yunchilat, because each Duryam knew that this was the day that would decide life or death. The Shri Yam Tees ensured that none of the Duryams could use its slaves for any desperate act of sabotage or self-defense. These slave seeds are designed with a failsafe. When telepathic contact with a Duryam is severed, each slave seed automatically immobilizes its slave by driving him mercilessly toward its parent, the coral tree basal from which slave coral was harvested. Shrieking sudden, inexplicable agony, the slaves scrambled for each domain's coral tree basal. Only actual physical contact with the coral tree basal could quiet a slave's pain. This organized the slaves into neat little clusters, keeping them safely out of the way until they could be most conveniently disposed of. Noma Nor glared at the image in the view spider's sack of optical jelly.
Why doesn't he do something?
Verger shrugged liquidly and leaned to one side to get a better look through the view spider's thicket of legs.
He is doing something. Just not what you expected.
The image in the optical jelly was barely more than a shadow in a twilight mist. The Shri Yam Tees blocked the view spider's image links along with the Duryam's control. To maintain its view of Jason Solo, it was forced to generate a shadow shape using the infrared-sensitive eye spots of the sessile polyps in the Amphistaff Grove.
Is he hiding? Is that it?
If so, he has picked the perfect spot.
The shadow of Jason Solo stood at the heart of the Amphistaff Grove.
And the polyps don't attack,
Nomanor muttered, gnawing absently on the edge of one knuckle.
Perhaps he and the polyps have reached some understanding.
Abruptly, Nomanor reached into a head-sized bubble den in the wall near his knee and grabbed a villa.
There is a slave in the Amphistaff Grove, he said into it. Pick him up, bind him, and return him to my coral craft.
The Villip whispered with a reply from the commander of Nomenor's Hooglet-masked warriors.
I hear and obey, Executor.
So...
Nomenor turned again to Verger.
As you say, our solo project has progressed well. The nursery has served its purpose. You should be planning the next phase of his training. You'll want to continue as soon as he's safely aboard my coral craft.
My people, Nomenor, Verger said meditatively, have a proverb about counting flitterflies when all one has is maggots.
Nomenor scowled.
What does that mean?
I believe, she nodded toward the viewspider's image sack, that you are about to find out.
Jason stands in the Amphistaff Grove, watching. Out of the shadows, out in the blue-white glare of the nursery's constant noon, four slaves suddenly step away from the nearest coral tree basil, letting its fronds drop from their hands. They don't seem to be in pain. This, Jason knows already, is because they're not really slaves. Out in the blue-white noon, the four slaves press the sides of their noses, and the Ooglyph maskers they had worn peel apart, filaments unthreading from pores to leave smeared beads of blood like sweat. The maskers ripple and flow down the revealed warriors, then squirm away to vanish in the grass. The warriors walk toward the Amphistaff Grove. The four warriors stop just beyond the fringe of the grove. Juvenile amphistaffs whip the air threateningly, and the polyps' ground mouths gape wide, mutely anticipating a rain of blood and flesh.
Jedi slave, come out from there.
They wear no armor. The only Von Dune crabs within reach are the wild ones that infest the bog beyond the coral tree basil, coming out at night to feed on the polyps at the edges of the grove. Unarmored warriors could not survive even seconds within the hissing swirl of juvenile amphistaffs.
Jedi slave, if we must come in, it will go worse for you.
The warrior turns and barks a command in the tongue of the Yuuzhan Vong. Two more false slaves step away from a coral tree basil and allow their Ooglyph maskers to slither down their legs. The newly revealed warriors grab a real slave. One holds him while the other crushes the slave's throat with a knife hand strike. They step back and let the slave fall, watching dispassionately while he writhes in the dirt, choking to death.
Jedi slave, come out! Or another will die. Save their lives, Jedi. Come out.
All right, Jason says quietly, a little sadly, if you insist. His still shadow becomes a shade in motion, drifting noiselessly through the grove of blood-hungry polyps. He stops at the penumbra, bordering the blue-white noon beyond. Here I am.
Farther, the warrior commands. Move beyond the reach of the grove.
Jason opens his empty hands.
Make me.
The warrior turns his head fractionally toward his companions.
Kill another.
You, Jason says, are no warrior. The leader's head snaps around as though yanked by a tractor beam.
What?
Warriors win battles without murdering the weak.
Jason's voice drips acid contempt.
Like all Yuuzhan Vong, you make war only upon the helpless. You are a coward from a species of cowards.
The warrior lunges, taloned fingers reaching to tear the eyes from Jason's face. With an exhausted sigh, Jason collapses before the warrior's rush, falling to his back, while lightly taking the warrior's outstretched wrists and planting one foot in the pit of the warrior's stomach to make a fulcrum. Jason rolls, kicking upward, and the warrior flails helplessly as he flips through the air into the blade storm of the amphistaffs. Jason lies for a moment in the sudden rain of Yuuzhan Vong blood and gobbets of warrior flesh. Then he rises. He faces the remaining three.
Well?
The warriors stand their ground, calling out in their own tongue. In answer to their call, Two of the squads who guard the Shree MTs lumber heavily forward bearing ampistaps of their own, bandoliers of thudbugs, and other less familiar weapons, and wearing full Von Dune crab armor. In a part of his mind, far from the pain and the blood and the harsh blue-white glare, Jason can feel the dark satisfaction of the ampistaff polyps behind him as they swiftly, almost instantly, digest the fallen warrior. Ampistaff polyps breed asexually. The ampistaffs themselves become a polyp's offspring, released from their nodules to squirm away in search of the proper ground to take root and begin their transformation into polyps themselves. Through his empathic connection, Jason shows them the ground he recommends. Trusting their friend, the ampistaffs take his advice. He stretches forth his arms. The warriors can only stare in open-mouthed awe as ampistaffs fall like leaves from the polyps at his back. As ampistaffs wriggle down the polyps' knobby leathern trunks and slither through the grass. Ampistaffs twine about Jason's ankles and climb his body like vines enveloping a forgotten jungle idol. They twist around his legs, his hips, his chest, coiling the length of his arms, shrouding his neck, curving up to embrace even his skull. Jason brings his hands together before him and offers the warriors a solemn bow. When he parts his hands again, a mature ampistaff stretches between them, blade and spike, fully envenomed, as is every one of the 17 ampistaffs that make up his armor. Jason says, "I'd like you all to meet some friends of mine." Nomanor hurled his sackworm across the chamber.
"Executor, let me go to him."
"Absolutely not. I can't have you running around in the middle of the Tizopil Yunchilat, you foolish creature. Don't you remember that our solo project is secret? How secret will it be after you run through the nursery trying to save his useless skin?"
"Hardly useless, Executor. As I said before, his education has proceeded very well indeed. Though I admit it could be going better right now."
"Could be better?"
Nomanor flicked his wrist at the view spider's optical sac, where the dim silhouette of Jason Solo armed himself.
"He has learned nothing. He cannot possibly win such a battle. How can he expect to fight two squads?"
"Winning," Verger said, her crest fanning a solemn blaster bore gray, "is not the same as fighting. Watch."
The shadow suddenly vanished, and the image within the optical sac shifted and flickered liquidly as the view spider sought new visual sources.
"What's happening?" Nomanor demanded uselessly. "Does he flee? Is he running away like the broken Jedi brat he has always been?"
Verger spoke without the faintest hint of irony. "I tell you this, though neither he nor they yet know it, he is the greatest of all the Jedi. Jason Solo is the living Jedi dream. Even without the Force, he is more dangerous than you can possibly imagine. You must let me go to him. He must be stopped."
"Stopped from what? Soiling his robe skin as he runs away?"
"Stopped from destroying the Tizopil Yunchilat. Stopped very likely from destroying the siege ship itself."
Nomanor's mouth came open, but from it came only a fading hiss.
"Don't you understand, Executor? He isn't running away."
She gestured at the view spider's sack, where it had recovered enough image to show a lone shape sprinting headlong to meet the oncoming thunderclouds of warrior squads.
Verger said, "He's attacking."
Jason Solo sprints into battle. As he runs, he makes an image in his mind. The ampistaff he carries matches itself to this image, coiling more than half its length around his forearm. An internal pulse from its linked chain of power glands generates an energy field that rigidifies its semi-crystalline cell structure, locking it in that form. A meter of it extends from his right fist, tipped with a double handspan blade. The same field that rigidifies the amphistaff extends a fractional millimeter beyond the blade, giving it an edge no thicker than an atomic diameter. So it is that when one of the unarmed warriors springs to bar Jason's path, hands wide to grapple, the blade passes with only a whisper of resistance through flesh and bone. One arm spirals lazily through the air, showering droplets of blood. One leg topples sideways, twitching in the grass. Jason does not even break stride. Thudbugs hum through the air around him, but the eye spots of the amphistaffs wrapped around Jason's body are infrared and motion sensitive. He is able to integrate their empathic reactions into a full surround field of perception that is not dissimilar to the force itself. And he has trained for years to avoid weapons that he can only barely perceive. Dozens more thudbugs curve toward him, homing like concussion missiles as he sprints straight at the oncoming squads of heavily armed warriors. The nearest warrior thrusts his amphistaff at Jason like a force pike. Jason dives beneath its point, rolling forward on his shoulder, stabbing upward. His blade enters the warrior's body at the joining of pelvis and thigh. A multiple blast bug detonation slaps the warrior forward, and Jason's blade shears through spine and armor alike to burst from the warrior's back in a fountain of gore, and slices as well through the warrior's blast bug bandolier. As Jason rolls backward with the concussion and kicks free of the shuddering corpse, he grabs the severed bandolier. An instant later, he is up again, running, staggering, stumbling, deafened and half stunned by the explosions. The bandolier is bleeding from its severed ends, dying. Its sole wish is to release its children, the blast bugs, locked in its linked belt of hexagonal germination chambers, so that they might fulfill their explosive destiny. Jason can keenly feel its desire. In the emotional language of his empathic talent, he promises the ultimate satisfaction of this desire, if the bandolier will only wait for his signal. Ahead, the remaining two squads draw themselves into a tight wedge, its point toward Jason, its broad base covering the back-to-tank-sized tub that holds the Shree Antees. As more blast bugs hum toward him from all directions, Jason heaves the bandolier overhand like a proton grenade. It twists lazily, high through the stark noon. With his empathic talent, he projects a pulse hammer thrill of anticipation, teetering over the brink to fulfillment, a shuddering surge of adrenaline that would roughly translate as now. The bandolier flares into a star shell over the base of the wedge, at the same time as the blast bugs, targeted on Jason, arrive in a thundering swarm, striking him and the ground and the warriors nearby indiscriminately. Concussion bursts, battering them all helplessly this way and that, ending with Jason finally blown off his feet into a high-spinning arc through the air. The blood-tinged darkness swallows him before he hits the ground.
There. You see?
Nomanor nodded contemptuously toward the suddenly vivid image in the view spider's optical sac, showing Jason lying unconscious, bleeding on the blast-shredded nursery turf, still within his improvised armor of amphistaffs. You see, but you do not see. Now in the image sac, two crab-armored warriors staggered into view, scorched, bleeding from multiple wounds. One passed too close to Jason's back, and one of the amphistaffs, braided around the human's torso, lashed out convulsively, spearing the warrior through the side of the knee. The other warrior kept running headlong, fleeing without a backward glance, and Nomanor soon discovered what the warrior fled from. A limping, snarling, shouting mob, bearing a variety of improvised weapons, from spade rays to maladillos to writhing wild amphistaffs, as much a danger to their wielder as to an enemy, which descended upon the hamstrung warrior to beat and chop him to death with savage triumph.
Those are slaves, Nomanor breathed.
The warriors were never his target, Vergère said, as though offering a hint to a puzzled child.
Finally, belatedly, he understood. The ball of ice inside his stomach sent freezing waves out to his fingertips.
He has killed the Shriam Tees.
The Tizo Peel Yunchilat dissolved in slaughter. Each Duryam, severed from its telepathic links by the Shriam Tees, had been forced to wait, blind and deaf, sizzling in a rolling boil of stress hormones, burning with the desperate hope that the next sensation it would feel might be the awakening of sense and power and the pure, clean knowledge that it alone had been chosen the Pashkik Yuzhantar Altirna, the world brain of God's Kresh. And so, when the Thudbug bandolier had burst, sending dozens of the explosive creatures rocketing into the tank that held the Shriam Tees, where the fluid bath that supported and nourished the Shriam Tees had multiplied their concussive force, sending an immense gout of fluid and blood and shredded flesh reaching for the fusion spark that was the nursery sun, all but one of the Duryams could not begin to guess what was going on. The one Duryam that knew what was going on was not shocked, or stunned, or panicked. It was simply desperate and ruthless. It had made a deal with Jason Solo. When the telepathic interference from the Shriam Tees had suddenly vanished, the Duryam not only knew exactly what had happened, it knew who had done it and why. And it knew what to do next. While echoes of the Thudbug bandolier still rang within the nursery, the Duryam sent its slaves scrambling away from the coral tree basils, scattering toward a number of Ooglith hummocks. These Ooglyths had been coaxed to conceal stacks of crude improvised weapons. The Ooglyths had also concealed a number of sackworms, filled to bursting with sparkbee honey. Sparkbees were the wild baseline from which Thudbugs had been shaped, uncounted years ago. By swinging a spade ray like a catapult, a slave might hurl one of these sackworms a considerable distance. The sackworms burst on impact, spraying gelatinous honey in every direction. The enzyme-activated sparkbee honey clung to whatever it struck. On contact with the nursery's air, it burst into flame. In seconds, fire was everywhere. Warriors, roasting to death within their useless armor, were unable to protect themselves, and even less able to defend the shapers they had escorted. And all but one of the Duryams shared a single thought: to gather to itself the slaves who were its eyes and hands. They had to pack their slaves onto the Hive Island, to surround themselves with walls of flesh. None of them had any other hope of self-defense, except for one. And so when all the slaves belonging to all the other Duryams sprinted from throughout the nursery, whipped onward by the coral seed web savaging their nerves, converging upon the hive lake to drown the double ring of warrior guards in waves of shuddering, clutching, bleeding bodies, the slaves belonging to one particular Duryam did not. Instead, they fanned out in teams of five. One team clustered around Jason Solo and waited while he dragged himself brokenly to his feet. The other teams raced through the smoke and flames, skipping over corpses and slipping on spilled blood, until they reached the coral tree basils. In seconds, the coral tree basils became towering columns of flame, fueled by sparkbee honey. Gnome Anor stared at the universe of bloody carnage within the view spider's sack with numb, uncomprehending horror.
Executor, we're running out of time.
Time? What time? This disaster. We are dead, don't you understand? Thabang La will slaughter us.
Ever the optimist, Berger chirped. You assume we'll live out the hour.
Gnome Anor glared at her speechlessly. Verger opened a hand at the view spider's optical sack.
Do you think he's finished, Gnome Anor? Does our avatar of the twin seek only confusion and slaughter? Or does he produce confusion and slaughter as a diversion?
Diversion? To accomplish what?
Then his good eye bulged wide. In the view spider's image sack, he saw Jason and the five slaves who accompanied him wade into the chest-deep murk of the Hive Lake, hacking their way through the churning, struggling, bleeding tangle of slaves and warriors. Nomanor breathed.
The Duryams.
They are the brains of the ship, Executor. He has already shredded the Teasel Pil Yunchilat, and he cannot hope to escape. What other target is worthy of his life?
Without a world brain to direct the separation and atmospheric insertion, the whole ship could be destroyed. He'll kill himself along with everyone else.
Nomanor's stomach roiled until he tasted blood.
He couldn't. I mean, could he? Would he?
Ah, Executor. What a happy place the universe would be if all our questions were so easily answered,
she chimed, opening her hands toward the view spider's image sack. It showed Jason Solo on the Hive Island shore, driving one of his blades through the chest of a maddened shaper, while with the other, he opened what might have been either a slave or a masked warrior from collarbone to groin. Two of his escorts survived. They had turned just at the waterline, where their blurring swipes of spade rays could not quite hold back a mob of suicidally fierce slaves. The two gave ground, forced backward up the beach, while Jason scrambled up onto the nearest of the huge Duryam chambers of calcified coral. He paused there, hesitating, standing atop the waxy hexagonal plug that sealed the birth chamber's end, his amphistaffs raised, again swaying as though he might faint. Then he drove his twin amphistaff blades downward through the plug. Nomanor covered his face with his hands.
Go, he said, his voice weak, muffled. Kill him if you must. Save the ship.
He heard the hatch open, then close again, and instantly he dropped his hands. In his eyes shone the clear light of simple calculation. He stroked the villip, snapped orders, then let it fall. When he opened the hatch sphincter, a swift glance assured him the tubeway was empty. Executor Nomanor ran for his coral craft as though pursued by crate dragons. He had not survived so much of this war by underestimating Jedi, particularly the Solo family. Killing Duryams got easier after the first one. Standing on the plug that sealed the mouth of the Duryam's hexagonal birth chamber, the wax warm under his feet, almost alive, he felt the searing terror of the infant Duryam trapped beneath him, smothering in panic claustrophobia, nowhere to run, no hope to hide, screaming telepathically, begging bitterly, desperately. He raised his twin amphistaffs over his head, then sank to one knee to drive them downward through the wax plug. He felt the blades enter the flesh of the infant Duryam below, as though they sliced through his own belly. He felt the caustic snarl of venom spreading into the Duryam's body, as though it coursed his own veins. He yanked the amphistaffs free and scrambled for the next birth chamber. He raised his last amphistaff like a battle flag. Before he could plant it down through the blood-smeared plug beneath his torn and cut bare feet, a supernova flared inside his brain and burned down the universe. There was nothing left. Nothing but white. Hungry white. Eating everything he was. Beneath this hexagonal lid was the source, the wellspring, the fountain of white. He could feel it down there, squirming alien tentacles bathed in slime and terror. He could cut off the agony. One stroke more would end it for everyone. Forever. He lifted his amphistaff. Jason, no! Don't do it! He whirled, staggering, white blind and gasping. The voice had been his brother's. Anakin, you can't kill this one, Jason. Anakin's voice said from beyond the white. This one's your friend. Like a finger flick against the beaker of supersaturated solution, Anakin's voice triggered a phase change in Jason's head. The white clouded, condensed, became crystalline, translucent, transparent, invisible. He could see again, clearly, perfectly. He saw the scarlet rags of meat that were the remains of three shapers caught before they could reach a breath vein on the far side of the nursery beyond the sun. He saw the smoking ring of charred coral tree bases around the hive lake. He saw the rivulets of blood trailing down his arms to drip from his knuckles. And he saw Vergère. Panting harshly, he watched her scramble up the last few meters of the Duryam hive.
"It was you," Jason rasped.
Vergère looked up. She stopped, well away out of amphistaff range.
"I heard him," he panted. His breath became hot and painful. "Anakin told me to stop, but it wasn't Anakin. It was you."
"Jason, in the story of your life, is this your best ending?"
He raised the amphistaff. But before he could bring it down, Vergère sprang forward into his way. To kill the Duryam, he'd have to spear through her. He hesitated for an eye blink, and in that instant, she reached up and caressed his cheek, just as she had the very first time her touch had drawn him down, out of the embrace of pain's blank white agony. Her palm was wet. "What?" But he said no more, because his mouth had stopped working. He had just enough time to think. Her tears. Vergère's tears. Before the paralytic contact poison they had become overwhelmed his brain. And the nursery, the Duryam, and Vergère herself all faded as he fell into a different personal universe. Infinite and eternal. This one was black. There was a world that had once been the capital of the galaxy. It had been called Coruscant, and was a planet of a single global city, kilometers deep from pole to pole. It had been a cold world with four moons, far from its blue-white sun, orbited by mirrored platforms that focused the light of the distant sun to prevent the world from freezing. Things had changed. Closer now to its sun, warm, tropical. Its kilometers deep global city, now kilometers deep global rubble, with new seas forming where once there had been apartment towers and government offices. Three moons now wove an orbital ring into a rainbow bridge in the sky. And above this world that had been a capital, this capital that had been a world, a shooting star flared. An immense globe of Yorick coral entered the atmosphere at a steep angle, shedding a planet-wide meteorite shower of bits and pieces and chunks of itself, and blossomed with fire as they streaked to the surface. Where they struck, they rooted and began to grow. The planet had ceased to be Coruscant. It had become Yuuzhan'tar. But soon it would be, once again, the capital of the galaxy.